Accession number 20483, reel 2.
Alan Guy, reel 2.
Yes, so we arrived in Japan, and Korea rather, in Busan. And I was then sent to join the 10th Field Hygiene Section, which at that stage was based in Busan itself. There, we didn't do a great deal. The section was waiting to go up north. The section consisted of a number of medical people like myself who trained in hygiene procedures, and we were totally self-contained. We had engineers with us, and we had drivers with us, and we had our own cook and other odd guys to make up a complete self-contained section. I was there for a short period of time, during which time I was just generally, you know, digging latrines, anything waiting to be moved out. Then I was promoted to corporal, and I was sent up north to a tiny little place north of Weijongbu, which is Uijongbu. And there were three of us sent up there, and the idea was we had to form a base for our section to move into. All I can remember about it, I could never find it again if I wanted to. It was in the middle of nowhere, not too far behind the lines. We heard continual gunfire the whole time we were there, and our main concern obviously was in case there were guerrillas infiltrating around the area. So we had to put on an all-night guard. There were three of us there, as I say, so every third night we were on a guard all night. Obviously, like all lads my age, when you were by yourself in the dark and you were scared stiff, although thinking back, the risks now weren't as bad as we probably thought at the time. It was all completely new, being out in the open by yourself and knowing that the enemy was somewhere out there close to you. And when you're in a small section, you feel totally isolated. Excuse me. You feel totally isolated. You don't have the backing of a big unit behind you. And if there was a big push, you wonder whether you'd be told about it or whether they'd all just come flooding past you and you'd hear about it when it was too late. Anyway, we did such things. We built up various bits and pieces for when our complete section moved up. We built latrines, we built like a wash-up area, which was just consisted of a bench with a couple of bowls on outside in the open. We had a small pump, so that if people wanted a shower, one end of the hose would be put in the stream, and the other end was a hose, which the sergeant major would hose you down. I've got photographs of him actually somewhere, of him hosing us down, and that would be bath night. Bitterly cold. The winters out there were incredibly cold. The summers were incredibly hot, and just to make life even more difficult, you'd have a small monsoon period in between, in which everything became muddy and with all the difficulties obviously which that generated. In fact, I can recall on one occasion, because our job from this base area, our job would be to go up to all the regiments, including the line regiments, and just see if there were any problems with regard to hygiene, disease, and so on. And we would give advice, including to the frontline troops. We'd give advice on such things as malaria problems, mosquito problems, for instance, if a frontline soldier threw an empty food can on the floor and that became full of water, ideal place for a mosquito to go in and breed. Consequently, you could get spread of malaria and so on. There were problems with, at that time, something called hemorrhagic fever, which was virtually fatal. If you got hemorrhagic fever, then you were in real trouble. At that stage, they didn't know what caused the problem, but it was thought that it might be a tick, which was would get onto a rat, and of course then it would be transferred to humans. Rats obviously carry disease, and rats were fairly rife out there. So we used to catch them, and we used to shoot birds and so on, and we would send them back to laboratories to check to see whether there was any form of mite attached to these which would cause hemorrhagic fever. So that was one of our jobs. We would generally instruct troops on, for instance, water purification. When you were behind the lines, you would have a large water tanker, and water would be gathered, we'll say, from a stream or something similar. The water would be, it would have a chemical put in, a chlorine type of chemical, which would chlorinate the water, make it safe, kill all the bacteria, and then you'd have to add detasting tablets to get rid of the taste of the chlorine. Now, the Americans, we used to have, I think it was one part per million of free chlorine in the water, which was enough chlorine to take care of any added bacteria. The Americans, I think their standard was about 14 parts per million of free chlorine. So as you can imagine, the taste was absolutely diabolical, particularly when you were drinking out of mess tins, and the mixture of the chlorine and the mess tins, it would taste terrible. So, as I say, one of our jobs was to teach them about water sampling. Teach them, we would show them how to, we'd pick the dirtiest little puddle we could lay hands on, and we would get them to scoop up a mess can full of this water, and then we'd pour it through a filter bag, and then we would chlorinate, then we would detaste, and then we would get them to drink it. And just to prove that they could drink the filthiest water imaginable and it could still be safe. And little things like this we used to teach. And obviously such things as just general sanitation. When troops were on the move, any fecal matter that was left behind, obviously flies would land on it, then flies would land on food. You'd have to teach them such things as the basics of cat sanitation, or if they were going to be in a war area for any length of time, then you would teach them to use small trenches, like 3 foot by 1 foot by 3 foot deep trench. If they were going to be there even longer, then they would use what they call deep trench latrines, which could be, I don't know, 10 feet deep, something like this. They would be about maybe 9 foot long to 12 foot long with a wooden superstructure above. So there were various types of sanitation depending on the length of time you were in a particular area. Obviously, there was there were things you would need to teach them about trench foot or any type of diseases caused by the climate, frostbite and so on. One of the natural things that would happen if somebody got frostbite in their hands, we'll say, they'd try and use some form of fire or heat to warm the hands. We used to suggest, don't do that. Try and reach body temperature first of all by putting your hands inside your mate's shirt and use his body temperature to heat your skin so you didn't cause more damage than was actually necessary. Obviously, once again, they caused a few comments when you suggested you should get your mate's feet and stick them inside your shirt. The usual, you used to get the usual comments. I'm not having his shoes into, I'm not having his feet inside my shirt, you know. But there were various other things. Sometimes, I remember one occasion being called upon to go up to Hill 355, where there were apparently some enemy bodies just below the trenches that were beginning to smell a bit. And you would need to give advice on what to do about that. Well, if they couldn't be brought out, then, you know, just sort of flamethrower or something similar, burn them. It's about the only thing you could do, really. couple of incidents that come to mind, I suppose, with regard to what one particularly with regard to the weather. It had been raining fairly heavily, and you were getting bogged down fairly regularly. The roads were particularly horrendous. I seem to remember they had a 15-mile-an-hour speed limit on tracks. They couldn't be called roads, really. They were tracks. And how we found our way around, I just don't know. There were usually map references. There were no road signs or anything. But this particular area we'd come to, and there were signs in various places which says, you're now under enemy observation. And you used to go through as quick as possible. I can remember our Jeep suddenly coming to a grinding halt in a hole, shell hole probably, something like this, that was absolutely full of water. And I can remember sitting there up to my chest in water, still in the Jeep, up to my chest in water and mud, and spending the rest of the day wandering around as this mud dried out inside your clothes and inside your boots. So conditions weren't too good during those times, during the monsoon period. also remember pitching a tent in on the edge of a hill and waking up in the middle of the night to see a small trickle of water coming through the tent. And we realised what had gone wrong, that we put it in the wrong place, and the three of us legged it as fast as we could. And next minute there's a raging torrent coming down the hill and going through the middle of the tent. These things happen fairly regularly. Summer months you would get fires breaking out on hills. I can recall we were on the side of a hill in a tented camp, and fire coming down the hill, and we spent all day trying to put these fires out. It was only scrub, so they weren't trees or anything there. I mean, they'd all gone long ago. But just scrub fires, which obviously, if that came through a tented camp, would cause absolute havoc. So that would be the summer months. Winter months, it was so cold, if you handled metal, then your skin had come off. You'd just stick to the metal. That created all sorts of problems. The other places we visited, the Hook. I think it was the Black Watch who were on the Hook at the time. I wasn't going there to do an inspection. They had a group of 4.2 mortars, and I was with a colleague of mine whose brother was with the 4.2 mortars, so we went up there to join them, just to see him. And they had these deep trench latrines which were covered in corrugated iron to make some sort of shelter for them. And I was inside there using one of the latrines when I heard gunfire, and it's one time when I was scared stiff, because not so much from the actual shells themselves, but the fact that I could end up down in this deep trench latrine in you-know-what. And I think that was my main concern at the time. As it so happens, it was outgoing. It wasn't incoming, so it didn't really matter at the end of the day. But at the time, it was one of the memories that stuck with me, and how worried I was about it. But for later on in 1952, I was asked whether I would go down to Pusan. I was being sent down there for a rest. And I went down there for about 3 months. And I was attached to, I think it was a holding centre or something similar. But my particular job there was inspecting the whole of the area round Pusan. Once again in a role similar to what environmental health officers do nowadays. And it was inspecting everything to do with the British Army. You would inspect military police barracks, you would inspect even the British legation I used to have to inspect. That was totally different to being up near the line. There was a certain amount of discipline there. There was a certain standard of cleanliness, although in the line you did, there was a standard of cleanliness, obviously in personal cleanliness, but I mean your clothes, you just couldn't keep those as clean as you would like. So it was more or less reverting back into normal army duties. And during that particular time, I had the opportunity to go back to Japan for a short while, just for, you know, a few days at a time. On one occasion, it was to take a prisoner. He was a Scots guy who was a constant troublemaker and was being sent back to Japan to a corrective institute. So I was able to go back, see a bit more of Kyuri, and at the same time I was able to carry on my training and be able to complete becoming a hygiene assistant class 2 and also a hygiene assistant class 1.
How did your prisoner behave when you escorted him?
Well, strangely enough, we thought he was the next best thing to Godzilla when we were told to pick him up. There was a sergeant major and myself, and the sergeant major was quite a big guy, ex-wrestler, and we'd heard all about this prisoner who was going to cause as much trouble as he possibly could, and we were told to take handcuffs. And the sergeant major walked into his cell, and he threw the handcuffs into a corner, and he said, "We're not going to need handcuffs for this," and immediately escorted this guy out. And when we were on the boat, and we had to go by boat over to back to Japan, and in the middle of the night, it was my turn to look after this prisoner, and he turned around to me, and he said, "What would you do if I jumped overboard?" I said, "Nothing, absolutely nothing." If, as I say, it was winter, icy cold, and if he'd have jumped overboard, he'd have gone to the bottom in no time. So, as far as I was concerned, if he jumped, he jumped. End of story. I met him again, strangely enough. He did his time and came back to Pusan. I was in the dining room when he came back, and he walked in, walked straight across to me, and I must admit I was very apprehensive because his reputation was absolutely horrendous. And he walked over, shook hands and said, "No hard feelings," which quite surprised me. But I understand that later on he beat up a Japanese girl and ended up 18 months in a Japanese prison. So that shows the standard of the guy he was. But as I say, I found after that he was okay with me. I didn't have any problems with him.
What was his name?
That I can't remember. All I remember is a Scots guy. But names are one of my failings, really. I can remember faces, but not names. But previously to, prior to going back down to Pusan, I'd been promoted to sergeant. So I was on a fairly good rate of pay, and I was quite happy with the army. And intended to make it my lifetime career, really. I went back up north. We moved again, just behind the lines. I can remember the constant noise of crickets, the constant gunfire, which it never seemed to stop. we were still doing the same thing, moving up north. Luckily, coming back at night time, although we went into the forward trenches, that was only in the daytime. And we were able to come back and have the comparative comfort of our own beds in the evening. I did actually watch as a plane napalmed an area not too far off the front. That memory remains with me for some reason. But I stayed in Korea until the prisoners of war started coming through. That was the end of the war in 1953, so I was there for close on 18 months. Our units were once again involved as the prisoners came through. One of the things we had to do was, and I didn't personally get involved in this, but my colleague did, dusting the prisoners with DDT to kill off any lice and so on. Because this was quite a regular thing. Any Koreans and any troops were dusted on a fairly regular occasion to kill off lice to prevent the spread of disease. Down in Busan and Seoul, particularly, that where they had young Korean ladies who were working for British or any army establishment, weren't at all happy, as you can imagine, when they'd be confronted with someone with a large gun full of DDT and would immediately proceed to put it up their arms and down their necks and up their trouser legs and so on, and they couldn't realise what we were doing. The equipment that was issued to the British troops by comparison with the Americans was very, very meagre. I think for rodent control, we were given an issue of, I think it was an ounce of arsenious oxide. That was once a month. I ran out of arsenious oxide on a particular occasion and decided to go scrounging from the Yanks, which was a fairly common occurrence because they had loads of equipment which they would give away willy-nilly, particularly if you had a few cans of beer or something similar. And I asked the Yanks whether they'd got any rat poison, and they produced one of these large sacks absolutely full of what looked like sweets. Now, we used to be very, very careful where we put poison, because obviously we didn't want to kill any wildlife or we didn't want to kill each other. But the Yanks, it seemed, they used to get handfuls of these things and used to just scatter them all over the place. There were kids running around, and I used to worry that some of these kids would pick them up, because arsenious oxide was quite a lethal type of poison.
What do you mean they looked like sweets?
Well, they were wrapped in a type of greasy paper. They just had a congealed lump of something with poison in it, and some, as I say, greaseproof paper wrapped around them. So, that, similar to like a toffee in a way. But I didn't hear of any problems regarding these, but, there was always... I'm very safety conscious, having been in that particular business. You're a bit concerned with health and safety as well as everything else. So, as I say, the prisoners of war came through, and it was just about that time that I was due to come home to England. And I came back on a troop ship. I think it was the Asturias. I can't remember for certain. I think it was the Asturias, with some of the prisoners of war, a few of the Gloucesters on board. And there was a problem on board ship, because one particular morning somebody went into the the toilet accommodation and found that somebody was dead. They had, from what I can recall, their throat cut and their wrists cut as well. And it was one of the Gloucester prisoners of war, I believe. They were put into the refrigerator that they used for food to bring them back to England. I think probably because there was a suggestion it could possibly have been done by their mates rather than a suicide, but they weren't too sure. However, unfortunately, round about that time, I went down with dysentery and was taken into the isolation hospital at the rear of the ship. So I didn't get any more detail about this. I did hear that it was decided eventually to bury the guy at sea, and I'm told this was done. But as I say, I was in no fit state myself to confirm these facts. And I don't know what his name was. I don't know any more detail about him.
What do you mean they were put in a refrigeration place?
Well, it, obviously because of the heat going through the Hong Kong, Singapore area and so on, they had huge refrigerators where all the food was kept for the ship. And that was the only place to keep him, really, if he was going to be transported home to England. So I know it doesn't sound very nice mixing food with a dead human, but I suppose there was no alternative as such. But, as I say, anyway, I remained in hospital. I was still in hospital when I came through the Suez Canal. Lost an awful lot of weight, if I remember rightly. I'm told that, apart from myself, there were quite a few other people who had gone down with the same thing, which I understand was due to the poor hygiene habits of one of the food handlers in the sergeant's mess. This is what I was told at a later stage. We arrived in Southampton Harbour, where we were told that if we had any souvenirs, they had to be offloaded overboard. I'd got a Chinese triangular bayonet, which I haven't seen in any of the museums around in this country. But unfortunately, being the sort of person who would do as I was told, I threw my bayonet overboard. I'm told that people threw burp guns and all sorts of other souvenirs overboard. So if the museum need any bits and pieces, I suggest dredging Southampton Harbour. Came home to this country, was then posted back to Aldershot for a short... No, I lie. Posted to Woolwich for a short while. Wasn't too happy being at Woolwich. My job there was a disinfestation centre. I was posted there, didn't seem to be doing much, and decided to try and get out of there to join the SAS. They were asking for volunteers at the time. I remember speaking to a major about this, and after they told me what was expected of me, decided that the SAS wasn't for me, but boredom was.
What was expected of me?
Although there were all sorts of things were suggested, which, they were talking about, oh, you might have to eat insects and remain out, under horrendous conditions by yourself for, sort of weeks at a time and so on. I thought, I think I'm probably better off doing what I'm doing now. That's lounging about. Anyway, I did complain about the fact that... I was a first-class tradesman, doing nothing, and I was posted to Horse Guards in London. which was probably one of the best postings I had. We had a small office. At one stage it was in Wellington Barracks, and at one stage it was actually in Horse Guards itself.